Welcome to the 100th edition of the Book Report. I am thrilled to have you with me today. Over the past 99 shows, we've previewed hundreds of books, and I've had the privilege of speaking with wonderful guests from every corner of the literary world. Today, in honor of the Book Report's centennial, I'm going to play it by the numbers, spotlighting new books with numbers in their titles. Because the show strives to have a title for every taste, we'll skip around genres as varied as thrillers, chick lit, science fiction, nonfiction, Hollywood bios, and much more. It's all ahead as we turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Let's start things off with one I think you'll love. And One Last Thing by Molly Harper. Lacey Terwilliger's shock and humiliation over her husband's philandering prompt her to add some bonus material to his company newsletter. Stunning Technicolor descriptions of the special brand of, quote, administrative support his receptionist gives him. Ah, revenge. But the stunt blows up in Lacey's face. Before one can say instant urban legend, Lacey has become the pariah of her small Kentucky town and the defendant in a defamation lawsuit. Her seemingly perfect life up in flames, Lacey retreats to her family's lakeside cabin, only to encounter an aggravating neighbor named Monroe. A hunky crime novelist with a low tolerance for drama, Monroe is not thrilled about a newly divorced woman moving in next door. But with time and a bottle of beer, or two or three, a cautious friendship develops into something infinitely more satisfying. Lacey has to make a decision about her long-term living arrangements. Should she take a job writing caustic divorce newsletters for paying clients, or move on with her own life? Can she find happiness with a man who tells her what he thinks and not what she wants to hear? And will she ever be able to resist saying one last thing? Amanda Ronconi narrates.
The card read, "To my bumblebee, happy anniversary with all my love, the Stinger." "The Stinger?" I read aloud, checking the name on the envelope. Sure enough, the card was addressed to Bumblebee. Mike had never called me that. In fact, in 8 years together, Mike had never given me a nickname. And it was nowhere near our anniversary. We got married on August 1st, not in the second week of June. "Cherry, honey, I think you got this delivery wrong," I called, chasing after her with the floral albatross. Cherry lived perpetually south of Buzzed, just drunk enough to avoid thinking about the fact that she'd been married to a very handsome asexual man for 20 years, but not too drunk to drive her delivery van. She looked over her delivery list and muttered to herself,
"Nope, it's right," she slurred. "Right here, it says Rose Romance Special Deluxe from Mike Terwilliger to..." "Oh, this is supposed to go somewhere else. This is supposed to go here."
She took an envelope out of her back pocket and handed it to me. She swayed slightly against her van and shook her head.
"Wait, no. Both of them are supposed to go..."
"Where are they supposed to go, Cherry?" I stuttered.
Cherry looked away from me, her eyes not quite able to focus anyway. "Oh, for Pete's sake," I snapped and tore the billing envelope open. Mike was listed as the ordering party. Next to Rose Romance Special Deluxe, Cherry's assistant had scribbled, "Terwilliger Office." My stomach clenched, ice cold. Somewhere, in a rationalizing corner of my brain, I clung to the hope that maybe Mike was planning to bring those roses home to me this afternoon as a surprise, and that he was planning on giving me the nickname Bumblebee. Oh, God. My husband was having an affair with a woman who called him the Stinger. And that's when it hit me. Bumblebee. Mike's receptionist was named B.B. Baumgartner.
"Sorry, Lacey. I'm so sorry," Cherry murmured, climbing into the van.
She knew. Soused, silly Cherry Glick had figured out my husband was having an affair before I had. Oblivious to the fact that my front door was standing open, I tugged my keys out of my pocket and ran for my Volvo. I tossed the roses into the passenger seat and, for some reason, took the time to secure the vase with the seatbelt. The next thing I remember was sitting in my car outside Mike's new offices on Spring Street, watching through the picture window as BB answered phones. She'd worked for Mike for a little over a year, replacing old Mrs. Keach after the secretarial dinosaur literally died at her desk. I had a healthy respect for the sunny girl-next-door exterior God had given me, but BB scared me with her stunning good looks. The kind of fine features that made me feel like my face was drawn with a crayon. Her hair was so dark, it seemed to absorb the light around it. It fell in soft, careless waves around her face, the kind I was always aiming for, but ended up with crazy blonde Shirley Temple curls instead. But I couldn't even complain that Mike only hired her for her face, or her perfect heart-shaped, or the she was still financing. She was very professional, had excellent typing and filing skills, was great at handling the clients. She answered the phone with a smile on her face, and she even made better coffee than I could manage. It was odd that Mike and BB seemed to be alone in the office. Mike had two accountants working under him, the associates in Terwilliger and Associates. He complained that all they did was hang around the lobby, ogle BB, and plow through pastries. Still, it was possible they were out on client visits. I sat there in an idling Volvo, feeling very stupid. Nothing was going on.
We've just heard "And One Last Thing" by Molly Harper White. Well, that title was fun, but perhaps we should commemorate our centennial with a bit more decorum. All right, then, let's have some fun by numbers and take a moment to check out some number one book rankings. Who doesn't love lists? In doing my research, I found that the Modern Library voted James Joyce Ulysses as the number one greatest novel of all times, followed by The Great Gatsby at number two, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, number three, number four, Lolita, number five, Brave New World, number six, The Sound and the Fury, Catch 22 is number seven, eight is Darkness at Noon, nine, Sons and Lovers, and 10, The Grapes of Wrath. Ulysses also got the number one spot from the Radcliffe Publishing Course panel, a group comprised of stars of the literary world, including Gore Vidal, Daniel Boorstin, Edmund Morris, and William Stryon. Newsweek magazine, on the other hand, gave Tolstoy's War and Peace the first spot. And the New York Public Library listed W.H. Auden's The Age of Anxiety as their top title. I haven't read that one. Must put it on my gotta-read-it list. As the top book by an American author, Goodreads honored Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. And what about our colleagues across the pond? Britain's The Observer gave the title of Best Novel of All Times to Cervantes' Don Quixote, while the BBC ranked Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings as number one.
We'll reference some more lists later, but now we're going to talk to Joseph Finder about book number two in this talented author's popular series. Welcome, Joseph. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Tell us a bit about Buried Secrets.
All right. I guess the easiest way to describe this is my continuing hero, a guy named Nick Heller, who's a private spy, now lives in Boston, and he is asked by an old family friend to help find his daughter. And the family friend is also a hedge fund titan, billionaire, and it turns out that the daughter has disappeared. Well, Nick says, this is a missing persons case. It's not, you know, it's for the FBI, not for me. The father says, I can't cooperate with the FBI because they're trying to nail me for all kinds of criminal activity. I need you to go and find my daughter the way you do it without involving law enforcement. So it starts off like that and basically becomes a quest story, a kind of an adventure story in which Nick is trying to find out the truth about where the daughter might have gone and the truth about her father, who he decides is actually concealing something really big. So it's sort of a family, it's a thriller combined with a family drama.
Is there such a thing as a private spy?
Yes, there are. And this is one of the things that I found very exciting when I decided to write one series character. I didn't want to do an FBI agent, didn't want to do a CIA agent or a homicide cop, because I sort of feel that those have been done by a lot of writers. And I wanted my own thing. And I had a friend who was in the CIA. I met him in London, and he told me that he was, in fact, working on his own for himself as a private spy in private intelligence. And it turns out that a lot of people have left the CIA and other agencies to go on their own and work for private citizens, corporations, politicians, even other countries. And they basically use the same set of skills that they had, that they drew upon when they're with the CIA or whatever. So there really are, it's kind of a growing group. People don't know much about it, but it's, to me, fascinating because they are like James Bond characters.
So Mr. Hedge Fund's name was Marshall Marcus in the book. Was he modeled after a Bernie Madoff?
You know, I honestly, this is the truth now. I came up with an idea for a hedge fund guy who is accused of running a huge kind of Ponzi scheme. And I sent it to my editor. Now, I have the email to prove this. I sent it to my editor a few days before the Madoff case was announced. So I was on to this before Madoff. It's not modeled after Madoff. It's modeled after a kind of a hypothetical, like what if, which I think is a lot more interesting than what Bernie Madoff is. And the puzzle is we don't know who this guy really is and what he's doing. So that's kind of part of the buried mystery in the book, is Nick trying to find out, is this guy another Bernie Madoff, or is he doing something kind of more sinister? Even more sinister, I should say.
Now, in doing the preparation for this book, you did something pretty unusual. The girl that's missing, without giving too much away, she's been buried alive. So tell us your experience.
Yes, well, being buried alive is, you know, Stephen King said once that you want to write about your greatest fears, and that will make them, other people connect with them, make them scary for other people. I wanted to write about a character who is buried alive, and I wanted to know what that was like short of actually being buried alive myself. So I did half of it, really. I went to a funeral home, and I asked them to lock me inside a casket. And I have to say it was not easy to find a funeral home that was willing to do this, but I got one, and they locked me in there, and our deal was that I would sort of let them know when it was time for me to get out of there, when I couldn't take it anymore. They close the lid. They'd lock it down. I could hear the kind of eek, eek, eek as they're locking the thing. And at first I thought, this is really comfortable. And then pretty soon I started feeling kind of woozy, and I realized I'm losing oxygen. I'm actually going to pass out. And that's when I began to panic. And I kind of banged on the lid of the casket, and they had gone somewhere, I guess. They didn't expect me to get out, want to go out at this point. So I had to, I mean, there was a good 5 or 7 minutes of my thinking, where the hell are they? So that was a kind of a scary little twist to that. But, you know, the interesting thing about doing research like this is you're able to describe the experience in a way that really feels genuine to people because you've been through it. You know the details, the sensory details that you can't read about or you can't Google. So, you know, I love research. I'm not willing, for example, to get shot in the leg if I want a character to be shot in the leg, but this is about as far as I would go, and probably I would never do it again, frankly, not when I'm alive.
Do you sleep with a nightlight now?
No, but that really, I am claustrophobic, and that was sort of facing down one of my greatest fears, but all in the name of research, you know.
Well, actually, I love your writing credo, reverse, reveal, surprise. Talk about that.
Well, every scene in every book has to move the story forward. And I sort of came up with this formula, and I have it hanging above my desk that says reverse, reveal, or surprise. That you've got to, each scene has got to change the expectations of the reader, twist things around like a kaleidoscope, or reveal something very interesting or exciting. And that's what makes a thriller a page turner. That's what makes you want to keep turning the pages, is if there's something always going on to sort of defeat your expectations and to sort of get you more and more further engaged in the story. So basically my rule is whether a chapter stays or goes when I'm editing, did it do one of those things? And if it didn't, it's gone.
When I was preparing for this interview, I saw you had once been asked the difference between a mystery, a suspense novel, and a thriller, and I loved your answer. Can you share that again?
Well, there's always kind of a debate about what the difference is between a mystery and a thriller, and the mystery is a whodunit, and a thriller is a howdunit. Okay, the mystery is about figuring out who the guilty party is, who killed the butler, who is blackmailing so-and-so, who is the rapist, whatever it is, finding out who. In a thriller, usually we know who the bad guy is, but we're watching how he's going to do something and will he get away with it. So the focus is on the process and the experience a lot more in a thriller, which is why I think thrillers are far more likely to be made into movies, because they're more viscerally exciting than mysteries, which, though they can be terrific, are much more in the head, much more cerebral.
So speaking about movies, are there big screen plans for Nick?
Well, there's a movie right now being shot of one of my books called Paranoia, with Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman and Liam Hemsworth. Nick, I'm not yet ready to sell the rights. We've had some offers. My feeling is I want to get this guy more established. I want there to be more of a following. I sort of want to get more adventures out there. And when there is kind of a critical mass, a kind of a following for Nick Heller, at that point I think I'll sell it. Before that, I'm concerned that the movie might not do it right.
The audiobook was narrated by Holter Graham. Were you involved in the choice, or were you involved in the production of that at all?
No, nothing at all. No involvement. My publishers decided they wanted to do a different voice for the Heller series, and they wanted someone who they thought would do Nick Heller in a fresh and interesting way. And you know, the funny thing is, I don't like listening to my audiobooks. It just kind of drives me crazy. I listen and I sort of think how I could have done it differently, right? But I heard a chunk of Holter Graham reading it, and I thought, he has the voices down. He's got this great way about him, and he's good at doing women.
What's next for you? Are you already working on your next book?
Yes, I am. I'm in the funny thing is, this has never happened to me before. I'm in halfway done with the new Nick Heller, and then a few months ago I put it down because I had a standalone idea set in Boston that I had to do. So when this is done, which should be fairly soon, I'll go back to Nick Heller, and then I'll have basically two books, and it's up to my publisher to figure out how to publish it. You know, I just provide the content.
And it's great content. Readers, I brought the book up to the Cape Cod conference with me, and my brother-in-law read it in a day and a half.
Is that right?
That's the truth.
I love hearing that, you know. There's a saying that, you know, easy reading is hard writing. And to make a book really fly by, you got to know what you're doing, you know. You got to put a lot of work into it. So I used to think, wait, it took me a year, and you read this in like 12 hours or 20 hours or whatever. Now I think that's actually a compliment. That's what we want. That's what we're aiming for.
Absolutely. It's one of the best books I've read this summer. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's great talking with you.
Let's hear a sampling of Joseph Finder's second book in the Private Spy Nick Heller series, Buried Secrets. Holter Graham narrates.
Taylor was right, of course. The bouncer didn't even ask to see their IDs. When they entered the hotel lobby, Alexa followed Taylor to the old-fashioned elevator, the kind that had an arrow that pointed to the floor it was on. The elevator opened, and an iron accordion gate slid open. Taylor got in along with a bunch of others. Alexa hesitated, slipped in, shuddered. God, she hated elevators. And just as the accordion gate was knifing closed, she blurted out, "I'll take the stairs." They met up on the fourth floor and managed to snag a couple of big cushy chairs. A waitress in a halter top so skimpy you could see the flower tattoo below her armpit took their order. A couple of Ketel One vodka sodas. "Check out the girls on the bar," Taylor shouted. Models in black leather butt-bearing shorts and black leather vests were parading around on top of the bar like it was a catwalk. One of the MIT frat boys tried to mack on them, but Taylor blew the guy off. "Yeah, I'll give you a call. Next time I need tutoring in, like, differential calculus?" Alexa felt Taylor's eyes on her. "Hey, what's wrong, kid? You've been acting all depressed since you got here." "I'm fine." "You think maybe you need to change meds or something?" Alexa shook her head. "Dad's just, I don't know, being all weird." "Nothing new about that." "But, like, he's all paranoid all of a sudden? He just had these surveillance cameras put in all around the house?" "Well, he is like the richest guy in Boston, or one of the richest."
I know,
Alexa interrupted, not wanting to hear it. She'd spent her entire life dealing with being a rich kid, having to play down the money so her friends didn't feel jealous.
"But it's not his normal control freak mode, you know? It's more like he's scared something's gonna happen."
"Try living with a father who's a friggin' United States senator." Taylor had started to look uncomfortable. She rolled her eyes, shook her head dismissively, looked around the now crowded bar. "I need another drink," she said. She called the waitress over and asked for a dirty martini. "How about you?" she asked Alexa.
"I'm good."
The truth was she hated hard liquor, especially vodka, and gin was the worst. How could anyone voluntarily drink that stuff? It was like chugging Listerine. Alexa's iPhone vibrated, so she took it out and read the text. A friend at some rager in Alston, telling her it was epic and she should come over. Alexa texted back, "Sorry." Then, abruptly, she said, Oh my God, did I ever show you this?" She flicked through her iPhone applications until she came to one she just downloaded, launched it, held the iPhone to her mouth. When she talked into it, her words came out high-pitched and weird, like one of the chipmunks.
"Hey, babe, wanna come back to my dorm and take off our clothes and do some algebra?"
Taylor squealed.
"What is that?"
She tried to grab the phone, but Alexa yanked it away, swiped the screen, and started speaking in the creepy voice of Gollum from Lord of the Rings. She said,
"Must have precious."
Taylor shrieked, then they both laughed so hard the tears came to their eyes.
"See, you're feeling better already, right?"
said Taylor.
"May I join you?"
a male voice. Alexa looked up, saw a guy standing there. Not one of the frat boys, though. Definitely not. This one had dark hair and brown eyes, a day's growth of beard, and he was totally a babe. Black shirt with white pinstripes, narrow waist, broad shoulders. Alexa smiled, blushed, she couldn't help it, and looked at Taylor.
Do we know you?
Taylor said. Not yet, the guy said, flashing a dazzling smile. Late 20s, early 30s, maybe? Hard to tell.
My friends ditched me. They went to a party in the South End I don't feel like going to.
He had some kind of Spanish accent.
We've just heard Buried Secrets by Joseph Finder. Two kids with the same name lived in a decaying city. One became a Rhodes Scholar, a decorated combat veteran, White House fellow, and business leader. The other serves a life sentence in prison. The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, by Wes Moore, is the story of two boys and the journey of a generation. In December 2000, the Baltimore Sun ran a small piece about Wes Moore, a local student who had just received a Rhodes Scholarship. The same paper also ran a series of articles about four young men who had allegedly killed a police officer in a botched armed robbery. The police were still hunting for two of the suspects who had gone on the lam, a pair of brothers. One was named Wes Moore. Wes, the scholar, just couldn't shake off the unsettling coincidence or the inkling that the two Wesses shared much more than space in the same newspaper. After following the story of the robbery, the manhunt, and the trial, he wrote a letter to the other Wes, now a convicted murderer serving a life sentence without possibility of parole. His letter tentatively asked the questions that had been haunting him. Who are you? How did this happen? That letter led to a correspondence and relationship that lasted for several years. Over dozens of letters and eventually prison visits, Wes discovered the other Wes had had a life not unlike his own. Both had grown up in similar neighborhoods and had difficult childhoods. Both were fatherless. They'd hung out on similar corners with similar crews. And both had run into trouble with the police. At each stage of their young lives, they had come across similar moments of decision, yet their choices would lead them to astonishingly different destinies. The author narrates.
Why did I feel like he carried part of me with him in that prison cell? I worried that I was just being melodramatic or narcissistic, but still, I couldn't shake it. Finally, one day, I wrote him a simple letter introducing myself and explaining how I'd come to learn about his story. I struggled to explain the purpose of my letter and posed a series of naive questions that had been running through my mind. Who are you? Do you see your brother? How do you feel about him? How did this happen? As soon as I mailed the letter, the crazy randomness of it all came flooding in on me. I was sure that I'd made a mistake, that I'd been self-indulgent and presumptuous and insulting, and that I'd never hear back from him. A month later, I was surprised to find an envelope in my mailbox stamped with the postmark from the Jessup Correctional Institution in Maryland. He had written back. Greetings, good brother, the letter started out. I send salutations of peace and prayers and blessings and guidance to you for posing these questions, which I'm going to answer, inshallah. With that, I'll begin with the first question posed. This was the start of our correspondence, which has now gone on for years. At the beginning of our exchange of letters, which was later expanded by face-to-face visits at the prison, I was surprised to find just how much we did have in common, aside from our names, and how much our narratives intersected before they fatefully diverged. Learning the details of his story helped me understand my own life and choices. And I like to think that my story helped him understand his own a little more. But the real discovery was that our two stories together helped me to untangle some of the larger story of our generation of young men. Boys who came of age during a historically chaotic and violent time and emerged to succeed and fail in unprecedented ways. After a few visits, without realizing it, I started working on this project in my mind, trying to figure out what lessons our stories could offer to the next wave of young men who found themselves at the same crossroads we'd encountered and unsure which path to follow. Perhaps the most surprising thing I discovered was that through the stories we volleyed back and forth in letters and over the metal divider of the prison's visiting room. Wes and I had indeed, as Weidman wrote, collapsed the distance between our worlds. We definitely have our disagreements, and Wes, it should never be forgotten, is in prison for his participation in a heinous crime. But even the worst decisions we make don't necessarily remove us from the circle of humanity. Wes's desire to participate in this book as a way to help others learn from his story and choose a different way is proof of that. To write this book, I conducted hundreds of hours of interviews with Wes and his friends and family, as well as my friends and family. The stories you will read are rendered from my own memory and the best memories of those we grew up with, lived with, and learned from. I engaged in extensive historical research and interviewed teachers and drug dealers, police officers and lawyers, to make sure I got the facts and the feel right. Some names have been changed to protect people's identities and the quiet lives they now choose to lead. A few characters are composites, but all of the stories are painstakingly real. The book is broken up into 8 chapters, corresponding to 8 years that had a decisive impact on our respective lives. The 3 parts represent the 3 major phases in our coming of age. Opening each of these parts is a short snippet of conversation between Wes and me in the prison's visitor's room. It was very important to me that we return again and again to that visitor's room, the in-between space where the inside and the outside meet. I don't want readers to ever forget the high stakes of these stories, and of all of our stories, that life and death, freedom and bondage, hang in the balance of every action we take.
That was The Other Wes Moore, One Name, Two Fates, by Wes Moore. Red Shirts, a novel with 3 codas by John Scalzi, is number 3 of our selects today. Ensign Andrew Dahl has just been assigned to the Universal Union capital ship Intrepid, flagship of the Universal Union since the year 2456. It's a prestige posting. Life couldn't be better. Until Andrew begins to pick up on facts that, 1, every away mission involves some kind of lethal confrontation with aliens. 2, the ship's captain, its chief science officer, and the handsome Lieutenant Kerensky always survive these confrontations. And 3, at least 1 low-ranked crew member is sadly always killed. Not surprisingly, a great deal of energy below decks is expended on avoiding, at all costs, being assigned to an away mission. Then Andrew stumbles on information that completely transforms his colleagues' understanding of what the Starship Intrepid really is and offers them a crazy high-risk chance to save their own lives. Will Wheaton narrates.
From the top of the large boulder he sat on, Ensign Tom Davis looked across the expanse of the cave toward Captain Lucius Abernathy, Science Officer King, and Chief Engineer Paul West, perched on a second, larger boulder, and thought, well, this sucks. Borgovian landworms, Captain Abernathy said, and smacked his boulder with an open palm. I should have known. You should have known? How the hell could you not have known, thought Ensign Davis, and looked at the vast dirt floor of the cave, its powdery surface moving here and there with the shadowy humps that marked the movement of the massive carnivorous worms. I don't think we should just be waltzing in there, Davis had said to Chen, the other crew member on the away team, upon encountering the cave. Abernathy, King, and West had already entered, despite the fact that Davis and Chen were technically their security detail. Chen, who was new, snorted. Oh, come on, he said. It's just a cave. What could possibly be in there? Bears? Davis had suggested. Wolves? Any number of large predators who see a cave as shelter from the elements? Have you never been camping? There are no bears on this planet, Chen had said, willfully missing Davis's point. And anyway, we have pulse guns. Now come on, this is my first away mission. I don't want the captain wondering where I am. He ran in after the officers. From his boulder, Davis looked down at the dusty smear on the cave floor that was all that remained of Chin. The landworms, called by the sound of the humans walking in the cave, had tunneled up under him and dragged him down, leaving nothing but echoing screams and the smear. Well, that's not quite true, Davis thought, peering farther into the cave and seeing the hand that lay there, still clutching the pulse gun Chen had carried, and which, as it turned out, had done him absolutely no good whatsoever. The ground stirred, and the hand suddenly disappeared. Okay, now it's true, Davis thought. Davis! Captain Abernathy called. Stay where you are! Any movement across that ground will call to the worms! You'll be eaten instantly! Thanks for the useless and obvious update, you... Davis thought, but did not say, because he was an ensign, and Abernathy was the captain. Instead, what he said was, Aye, Captain. Good, Abernathy said. I don't want you trying to make a break for it and getting caught by those worms. Your father would never forgive me. What? Davis thought, and suddenly he remembered that Captain Abernathy had served under his father on the Benjamin Franklin. The ill-fated Benjamin Franklin. And, in fact, Davis's father had saved the then-ensign Abernathy by tossing his unconscious body into the escape pod before diving in himself and launching the pod just as the Franklin blew up spectacularly around them.
That was Red Shirts, a novel with three codas by John Scalzi. Bryce Courtenay's Four Fires follows the Maloneys, a fifth-generation Australian family of Irish Catholic descent. Struggling to reach the first rung of the social ladder in their small town, a father broken by war, a mother who must be strong, three boys and two girls, see their lives changed forever by the Four Fires: passion, religion, warfare, and fire itself. This is a compelling story of the power of love and the triumph of the human spirit against the odds. As Courtenay writes it, the Four Fires give Australians their sense of place and, for better or worse, shape the national character. Narrator Humphrey Bauer offers a fabulous performance, delivering a cast of characters captured brilliantly with nuance and emotion.
Us Maloneys had a bad reputation in Yankalilly, which wasn't entirely fair, but then things in small towns seldom are. Sergeant Donovan once told Nancy, our mum, that never you mind, there were a lot worse than us around. Maloney is an Irish name, and we were Catholics, but we didn't go to St. Stephen's, the Catholic school, which meant we weren't just mixed, but dirt poor as well, and couldn't afford the fees. Nancy said she probably could have talked to them, but she was buggered if she was going to go cap in hand to anyone, even to His Holiness the Pope, or his local representative, Father Crosby. Later I came to understand it was because of the nuns. Nancy was afraid that because she'd had four of us out of wedlock, the nuns would have a go at us and make things miserable. This act of independence and protection in the face of hardship made us one of only a few Catholic families at the local state school, which was not a good situation to find yourself in, but probably not as bad as the nuns being against you. I didn't see it at the time. Kids don't. But now, when I look back, I can see why being Church of England was somehow many notches up from being a Catholic. 1955 was just about the last gasp of the old colonial system, where Catholic and Protestant were separated by what Nancy called the Great Divide, which had begun long before the first convicts of either religion reached Australia. Ireland has always been the racial malignancy in the English bloodstream, and it continued to manifest itself in country towns in Australia, where after five generations, the Pope and the Queen were still at loggerheads. But around this time, the great influx of poor European migrants started to arrive, and small country towns such as Yankalilly found themselves having to deal with people whose names ended in Itch, Vitch, Zach, Zov and Ski. Strange folk who stumbled and tripped over perfectly ordinary words in our mother tongue. They were called refos, and people said they'd been through a hard time and were willing to do anything to get on. One girl in my class, her name was Anna Dombrowski, but we called her Anna Dumkowski because she talked sort of slow and her English words were pronounced funny. She once stood up in class and told us her family had been in a concentration camp in Poland. I remember Crocodile Brown, our teacher, shook his head slowly, then said how terrible it was and how her family had suffered enough and he hoped Australia would be different for them now they were safe. Them was only her and her mum, because her dad was dead. That afternoon, Bozo and me were building a billy cart from four pram wheels we'd collected. "What's a concentration camp?" I asked him. He considered for a moment. "It's where they send you to learn to concentrate," he said at last. "It's in Pooland," I said. "Yeah? Pooland?" You could see he'd never heard of the place, but then he decided he had the answer. "Yeah, well, what do you expect? It's like us. We get into in class when we're not concentrating." Normally he would have said, "We get into the sh-," and he seemed pretty pleased with the answer he'd invented. You could never tell with Bozo. Sometimes he came up with things you didn't think he ought to have known. Maybe this was one such occasion. "But a whole camp. They got sent to a camp in Pooland for punishment. Imagine that, eh? We only get to stand in the corner and don't even get the strap for not concentrating." "Yeah, well, they must have been really bad," he said in an offhand sort of way. I could see he'd lost interest. "Yeah, they suffered terribly. But Crocodile Brown said he hoped Australia would be different for them now they were safe." "Course it will. Stands to reason. We're different, see? We don't have to concentrate that much."
That was Four Fires by Bryce Courtenay. Audrey Hepburn is an icon like no other. Yet the image many of us have of her, dainty, immaculate, is anything but true. Here, for the first time in Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., Breakfast at Tiffany's and the Dawn of the Modern Woman, Sam Wasson presents the woman behind the little black dress that rocked the nation in 1961. The first complete account of the making of Breakfast at Tiffany's, 5th Avenue 5 a.m., reveals little-known facts about the cinema classic, like Truman Capote desperately wanting Marilyn Monroe for the leading role, director Blake Edwards filming multiple endings, and Hepburn's conflict about balancing the roles of mother and movie star. With a colorful cast of characters, including Edith Head, Givenchy, composer Henry Mancini, and, of course, Capote and Hepburn, Wasson immerses us in the America of the late 50s, before Woodstock and birth control, when a not-so-virginal girl by the name of Holly Golightly raised eyebrows across the country, changing fashion, film, and sex for good. Grover Gardner narrates.
There was always sex in Hollywood, but before Breakfast at Tiffany's, only the bad girls were having it. With few exceptions, good girls in the movies had to get married before they earned their single fade to black, while the sultrier among them got to fade out all the time, and with all different sorts of men in just about every position of rank. Needless to say, they paid for their fun in the end. Either the bad girls would suffer slash repent, love slash marry, or suffer slash repent slash marry slash die. But the general idea was always roughly the same. Ladies, don't try this at home. But in Breakfast at Tiffany's, all of a sudden, because it was Audrey who was doing it, living alone, going out, looking fabulous, and getting a little drunk didn't look so bad anymore. Being single actually seemed shame-free. It seemed fun. Though they might have missed it or not identified it as such right away, people who encountered Audrey's Holly Golightly in 1961 experienced, for the very first time, a glamorous fantasy life of wild, kooky independence and sophisticated sexual freedom. Best of all, it was a fantasy they could make real. Until Breakfast at Tiffany's, glamorous women of the movies occupied strata available only to the mind-blowingly chic, satin-wrapped, ermine-lined ladies of the boulevard, whom no one but a true movie star could ever become. But Holly was different. She wore simple things. They weren't that expensive. And they looked stunning. Somehow, despite her lack of funds and backwater pedigree, Holly Golightly still managed to be glamorous. If she were a society woman or fashion model, we might be less impressed with her choice of clothing, but because she's made it up from poverty on her own, and is a girl, no less, Because she's used style to overcome the restrictions of the class she was born into, Audrey's Holly showed that glamour was available to anyone, no matter what their age, sex life, or social standing. Grace Kelly's look was safe, Doris Day's undesirable, and Elizabeth Taylor's, unless you had that body, unattainable. But in Breakfast at Tiffany's, Audrey's was democratic. And to think that it almost didn't come off. To think that Audrey Hepburn didn't want the part, that the censors were railing against the script, that the studio wanted to cut Moon River, that Blake Edwards didn't know how to end it, he actually shot two separate endings, and that Capote's novel was considered unadaptable seems almost funny today. But it's true. Well before Audrey signed on to the part, everyone at Paramount involved with Breakfast at Tiffany's was deeply worried about the movie. In fact, from the moment Marty Giroux and Richard Shepard, the film's producers, got the rights to Capote's novel, getting Tiffany's off the ground looked downright impossible. Not only did they have a highly flammable protagonist on their hands, but Giroux and Shepard hadn't the faintest idea how the hell they were going to take a novel with no second act, a nameless gay protagonist, a motiveless drama, and an unhappy ending, and turn it into a Hollywood movie. Even when it was just a book, Breakfast at Tiffany's was causing a stir. Despite Capote's enormous celebrity, Harper's Bazaar refused to publish the novel on account of certain distasteful four-letter words.
We've just heard Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m. by Sam Wasson. Now, here's a toast to our sixth selection in today's Centennial Book Report. Throughout human history, certain drinks have done much more than just quench thirst. As Tom Standage relates with A History of the World in Six Glasses, six of them have had a pervasive influence on the course of history. Readers follow the story of humanity from the Stone Age to the 21st century through the lens of beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and cola. Beer first appeared in the Fertile Crescent. By 3000 BCE, it was so important to Mesopotamia and Egypt, it was used to pay wages. In ancient Greece, wine became the main export of her seaborne trade, helping spread Greek culture far and wide. Spirits such as brandy and rum fueled the age of exploration, fortifying men on long voyages and oiling the pernicious slave trade. Although coffee originated in the Arab world, it stoked revolutionary thought in Europe during the Age of Reason, when coffee houses became centers of intellectual exchange. And hundreds of years after the Chinese began drinking tea, it became wildly popular in Britain, with far-reaching effects on British foreign policy, including our own Boston Tea Party. Finally, though carbonated drinks were invented in 18th century Europe, they became a 20th century phenomenon, with Coca-Cola in particular the leading symbol of globalization. Each drink was a catalyst for advancing culture and starting an intricate interplay of different civilizations. You may never look at your favorite beverage the same way again. Sean Renette narrates.
Not only did beer nourish the inhabitants of the first cities and the authors of the first written documents, but their wages and rations were paid in bread and beer, as cereal grains were the basis of the economy. The flourishing culture that developed within the city-states of ancient Greece in the first millennium BCE spawned advances in philosophy, politics, science, and literature that still underpin modern Western thought. Wine was the lifeblood of this Mediterranean civilization and the basis of vast seaborne trade that helped to spread Greek ideas far and wide. Politics, poetry, and philosophy were discussed at formal drinking parties, or symposia, in which the participants drank from a shared bowl of diluted wine. The spread of wine drinking continued under the Romans, the structure of whose hierarchical society was reflected in a minutely calibrated pecking order of wines and wine styles. Two of the world's major religions issued opposing verdicts on the drink. The Christian ritual of the Eucharist has wine at its center. But following the collapse of the Roman Empire and the rise of Islam, wine was banned in the very region of its birth. The rebirth of Western thought a millennia after the fall of Rome was sparked by the rediscovery of Greek and Roman knowledge, much of which had been safeguarded and extended by scholars in the Arab world. At the same time, European explorers, driven by the desire to circumvent the Arab monopoly on trade with the East, sailed west to the Americas and east to India and China. Global sea routes were established, and European nations vied with one another to carve up the globe. During this age of exploration, a new range of beverages came to the fore, made possible by distillation, an alchemical process known in the ancient world, but much improved by Arab scholars. Distilled drinks provided alcohol in a compact, durable form ideal for sea transport. Such drinks as brandy, rum, and whiskey were used as currency to buy slaves, and became particularly popular in the North American colonies, where they became so politically contentious that they played a key role in the establishment of the United States. Hard on the heels of this geographic expansion came its intellectual counterpart, as Western thinkers looked beyond long-held beliefs inherited from the Greeks and devised new scientific, political, and economic theories. The dominant drink of this age of reason was coffee, a mysterious and fashionable beverage introduced to Europe from the Middle East. The establishments that sprung up to serve coffee had a markedly different character from taverns that sold alcoholic drinks, and became centers of commercial, political, and intellectual exchange. Coffee promoted clarity of thought, making it the ideal drink for scientists, businessmen, and philosophers. Coffeehouse discussions led to the establishment of scientific societies, the founding of newspapers, the establishment of financial institutions, and provided fertile ground for revolutionary thought, particularly in France. In some European nations, and particularly in Britain, coffee was challenged by tea imported from China. Its popularity in Europe helped to open lucrative trade routes with the East and underpinned imperialism and industrialization on an unprecedented scale, enabling Britain to become the first global superpower. Once tea had established itself as Britain's national drink, the desire to maintain the tea supply had far-reaching effects on British foreign policy, contributing to the independence of the United States, the undermining of China's ancient civilization, and the establishment of tea production in India on an industrial scale.
We've just heard History of the World in Six Glasses by Tom Standage. Okay, never let it be said that the book report is formulaic or predictable. The next book we'll preview on our centennial show is 14 by Peter Kleins. Padlocked doors, strange light fixtures, mutant cockroaches. There are some odd things about Nate's new apartment, but with so much on his mind, he doesn't have the time to notice. He hates his job. There's no money in his bank account, no girlfriend, and no plans for the future. So, while his new home isn't perfect, it's livable. The rent is low, the property managers are friendly, and the odd little mysteries don't nag at him too much. At least, not until he meets Mandy, his neighbor across the hall, and notices something unusual about her apartment. And then Tim's apartment. And then Veek's place. It seems every room in this old L.A. brownstone has a mystery or two, something stretching back over 100 years. Some of them are in plain sight. Some are behind locked doors. Could these mysteries mean the end of Nate and his friends? Or the end of everything? Ray Porter narrates.
Nate Tucker found out about the apartment as people often learn about the things which change their lives forever, by sheer luck. It was a Thursday night party he didn't want to be at. Party was too big a word for it, but calling it a few rounds after work seemed too minor. There were half a dozen people he knew and another dozen he was supposed to know. He hadn't really paid attention when they'd been introduced, and none of them seemed interesting enough to go back and learn their names after the fact. They sat around tables that had been pushed together, shared communal appetizers some people would argue they'd never touched, and sipped overpriced drinks they made a point of claiming they'd first had at more exclusive restaurants. Nate had realized a while back that nobody talked with each other at such gatherings. People just took turns talking at each other. He never got the sense anyone was listening. He wished his co-workers would stop inviting him. Nate was being talked at by a man he remembered as the journalist with the hot redhead girlfriend. He'd been introduced to the man at one of these things a month or two back. Like everyone else at the table, the journalist considered himself part of the film industry, even though, as far as Nate could tell, the man's job had nothing whatsoever to do with making movies. At the moment, the journalist was lamenting a canceled interview. His subject, a screenwriter, had to dive into last-minute rewrites demanded by some producer. Nate wondered if the man got to put that sort of thing in his articles. Idiotic revisions made to climactic scene to pacify self-centered executive. There was a break in the journalist's monologue, and Nate realized the man was waiting for a response. He covered the pause with a cough and took a hit off his beer. "That sucks," Nate said. "Do you lose out altogether, or can he reschedule?" The journalist shrugged. "Maybe. My week's packed, and he's going to be busy pulling his hair out." He took a sip of his own drink. "Anyway, enough about me. What's up with you? I haven't seen you at one of these things in ages." Nate, who remembered waving to the journalist at last week's almost party and getting a raised chin back, shrugged too. "Nothing much," he said. "Weren't you working on a script or something?" Nate shook his head. "No, not me. Not my thing." "So what have you been up to?" He took another hit off his beer. "Work. Trying to find a new place to live." The journalist's brow rose. "What happened?" "The guys I've been living with, they decided to do their own thing," said Nate. "One's moving back to San Francisco, the other's getting married." He shrugged. "We had a house, but I can't afford it on my own." "Where are you now?" "Silver Lake." "You looking for anything in particular?" Nate considered it for a moment. It was the most anyone outside of his roommates had asked about the search. "I'd like to stay near Hollywood," he said. "I don't need much space. I'm hoping to find a studio for around $800 a month. The journalist nodded and took another sip of his drink. "I know a place."
"You do?"
The other man nodded. "A friend of mine suggested it when I first moved here from San Diego. Older place in that Koreatown Los Feliz Gray area around the 101. Nate nodded. "Yeah, I know right where that is. It's closer to work than the place I'm in now." Another nod from the journalist. "I was only there for a few months, but the rent was cheap, and it had a great view." "How cheap?" The journalist glanced around. "Between you and me?" he said. "I was paying $550. Nate choked on some beer.
$550 a month? That's it?"
The journalist nodded. $550.
"Yep.
And that included all the utilities."
"You're shitting me."
"Nope. Why'd you leave?" The journalist smiled and gestured with his glass at his hot redhead girlfriend. She was across the table and down a few seats being talked at by a woman with jet black hair and matching clothes.
That was 14 by Peter Kleins. Readers, to end our show, I thought you'd enjoy some beloved last lines of novels. These are from The Stylist UK's list. The Great Gatsby is number one with, quote, "So we beat on, boats against the currents, borne back ceaselessly into the past," unquote. Of course, the next one I know you'll recognize. "After all, tomorrow is another day. Thank you, Miss Scarlet." Number three, from To Kill a Mockingbird, quote, "He turned out the light and went into Jem's room. He would be there all night, and he would be there when Jem waked up in the morning." Number four, from The Bell Jar, quote, "The eyes and faces all turned themselves toward me, and guiding myself by them as by a magical thread, I stepped into the room." And number five, "The creatures outside looked from pig to man, and from man to pig, and from pig to man again. But already it was impossible to say which was which." And that, of course, is Animal Farm. As we approach our last line from this special edition, I want to send very special thank yous to those people who've helped create the show and who make it happen each week. Derek Hewitt, the most amazing executive producer. Dave Hain, my rocksteady editor. Steve Johnson, head honcho of Outpost Audio.
and Oli Vargas, producer extraordinaire. Thanks so much for joining my centennial celebration, and let's meet back here next week for Book Report 101.